Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. I will be your chair for today's program, which is The Arab Spring, Looking Back in 2013. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. Joel Brinkley is a Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent, former bureau chief for the New York Times in Jerusalem, and now professor of journalism at Stanford University, and a syndicated columnist whose work appears in many newspapers, including, I must note, the San Francisco Chronicle every Sunday. Laila El-Sisi is an Egyptian-American businesswoman and author who recently returned from Egypt. And Boubacar Kanté is from Mali and Gabon. He received his PhD in physics in France and is a postgraduate researcher in advanced physics at UC Berkeley. Boubacar recently visited Mali. Let's start by asking Joel Brinkley to come up and give us a little overview of the situation in the Middle East and Northern Africa. Joel Brinkley.
Thank you. I was just going to say that's not the right name. Hello, everyone. I'm delighted to be here again. Talking about a subject all of us have been following for the last couple of years, the so-called Arab Spring, and I accent the phrase so-called. You know, a lot of people have been saying recently that the Arab Spring is actually began in Iraq in 2003 when the United States threw out Saddam Hussein. That was 10 years ago, and I think if you look at what has happened in Iraq since then, it clearly foretold what we are seeing now in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, and other states in this so-called transition. In Iraq, we replaced one dictator with another. None of the freedoms that we encouraged, freedom of the press, religion, or assembly, as examples, have been upheld. When I first worked there late in 2003, there were new newspapers all over the place, new broadcast stations, new radio stations, all with screaming headlines and nobody censoring them. Now, I mean, it was really exciting. And now, of course, all of them are gone or they're muzzled. And just a few days ago, gunmen from a Shiite militia, and remember Prime Minister Maliki's government is Shiite, burst into the offices of several independent newspapers where they beat up and stabbed the editors and reporters because they'd written stories criticizing a certain Shiite cleric. You know, I've spent a lot of time in Iraq over the years, most recently just before I left the New York Times in 2006. And I was traveling then with the Secretary of State, and we stayed overnight, and members of the press were sent out back to what they called the transient trailers. These were little tiny rooms with a bed and a bedside table and armoire, and I could touch both walls with my hands. It was that small. So I called home on my satellite phone and told my wife and my daughter that I was staying in a room about the size of a jail cell, and my daughter, who was in first grade, went to school and during current assembly and said, "My dad's in jail in Iraq." That caused a bit of a sensation, I have to say, when I got home. So when you look at the Arab Spring, an aphorism comes to mind for me as a journalist. It's the guideline for foreign correspondents. It is this: a journalist working abroad should never take the lifestyle and culture of his own country, impose it on another country, and judge them accordingly. In other words, if we go to Saudi Arabia, should we rip into the country for not giving women equal rights? Maybe, but actually, you know, there are certainly laws and policies in Saudi Arabia that might motivate a reporter to do that, an American reporter, and I don't agree with a lot of what they do, but then I'm not a Wahhabist Muslim. So you do not take your point of view and impose it on another country until they do something that is considered universally wrong. Now, what's that have to do with the Arab Spring? we in the West, in general, have been looking at the uprisings in the Middle East, Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, through our own vision of what society ought to be. These people rioting the streets, obviously they want freedom and democracy. That's how we all look at it. And they want all the benefits that come from that. But that's our vision. It isn't their vision. Remember in 2011 when President Obama described the uprisings as, quote, an historic opportunity for the United States to pursue a world as it should be, end quote. Should be, according to whom? Of course, we know what kind of world he's talking about, one just like the United States. Hillary Clinton expanded on that by saying Washington should help advance security, stability, peace, and democracy in the Middle East. And the 2012 Republican Party platform last year described the Arab Spring as a movement to, quote, unleash democratic movements across the Middle East. Well, that's just not true. This was another case of we in the West intellectually imposing our view of the best, most appropriate society and culture on the Egyptians, Libyans, and others. Now, we all hope everybody eventually lives in a democratic state. But think about how the Arab Spring began on December 17, 2010, when Libyan street vendor Mohamed Bouazizi self-immolated in Tunisia. He'd been humiliated when a municipal inspector and her aides harassed him and confiscated his fruit. Was Bouazizi angry at that moment because he didn't live in a democratic nation? No. He was humiliated. He wanted respect. And I would argue that the cause motivating most everyone in the Arab Spring, more than anything else, was a hunger for respect. And after that, comes a thirst for greater prosperity, and then perhaps unspecified new liberties. Well, now we know that the people in these countries did not win respect, prosperity, or greater freedom of any kind. Look at Egypt, riots almost daily, the burning of Muslim Brotherhood offices, and a country on the verge of economic self-immolation. As opposition figure Mohammed al-Baradei put it this week, Egypt is now collapsing on the political and economic levels, and we are paying a dear price, all because of a lack of rationalism in the policies of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi. Now, that's an opposition politician speaking, but there is a lot of truth to what he said. Morsi was, of course, elected, but he had no experience in government, none. And he seems to have no idea what he's doing. He wants a loan from the IMF to pull his economy out of the mire, but he needs to cut bread and other rations to do that. The last time the government did that in 2008, I was there and I saw the riots. That's a dilemma for him. Morsi is unwilling to pay interest on the loan from the IMF because fundamentalist Islamic law forbids it. They call it usury, which of course means unethical loans. And the Quran says, God will war with you if you do not give up the usury that is outstanding. So even if he can meet the IMF's difficult terms, he still has to convince the IMF to structure the loan repayments as if it were not interest. Egypt's foreign currency reserves have fallen from $35 billion to $12 billion because the country is broke, there's no tourism. And so he's just spending them. Tourism has fallen to almost zero. The value of the Egyptian pound has fallen by 20% in the last few months. And you go around the Middle East and you see similar problems. As you know, the Libyan government does not have control over most of the country. Various militias, some of them extremists, run around the state unchallenged in Libya's central government seems unable to disarm them. That led to the attack on the U.S. Embassy and the death of the U.S. ambassador a few months ago. Tunisia is probably the most promising of the three states, but as you probably know, Salafist Islamist extremists stormed the U.S. Embassy in September. They are believed to be the ones who assassinated leftist politician Chokri Belaid in February. These two events forced the moderate prime minister to resign, and a new one was appointed. All of these states are in various states of foment. No one there is calling for Western democracy, even now. Still today, Freedom House says that 85% of the people in the Middle East and North Africa lack basic freedoms and civil liberties. But that's pretty bleak, but I do think we have to be patient. These are very rough, disappointing introductions to change in the Middle East. But it's going to take time, maybe a long time. It's been only 2 years now. Still, I'm convinced that down the road, the Arab Spring will be seen as the beginning of something that eventually will turn positive for the region's people. It may take a very long time. But if we are patient and we sort of watch and hope for the best, I think eventually there will be changes that are positive. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joel, for a really interesting overview. This will be me momentarily, and we're going to play musical chairs again. Next, we're going to hear from Lila El-Sisi, who is an Egyptian-American businesswoman and author, who is going to give us some insights from her recent trip to Cairo and what she thinks of recent developments in Egypt. Lila, welcome.
I just want to say, Joel, sitting next to you with such an impressive resume compared to mine, I said to myself, Lila, you have two things that Joel doesn't have. I'm a woman and Egyptian. What I'm going to say right now, I was in Egypt in January, and I met a lot of people from different level of education, and like I met a taxi driver, a vendor, and college students, and we sat together, and I was completely taken by surprise how much they knew and how much they are using the internet to know about what's going on in Egypt, in their own country, and in the Middle East. They don't actually follow any news on Al Jazeera, CNN, MSNBC, or even the local news in Egypt. They have their own way of following the news. They go in Tahrir, and they meet, and they know minute by minute what's going on, and that's what I get on my Facebook. They are all on my Facebook, and I am minute by minute. Sometimes I have my phone next to me at night, and I open to go to the restroom, and then I turn on, and I read the news for maybe 1 hour, because when I am sleeping, they are up and having the news. So when Hillary Clinton and Kerry went to Egypt, they were so angry. And what I'm going to tell you right now, what I'm going to read, because I want to read it, it's too much, I don't want to shift from the subject, is what all of them agreed upon when I was with them. So bear with me. I'm sure most of you have been following the news closely and seeing what's happening in Egypt right now and are rather confused. Let me assure you that Egyptian citizens down on the ground in Egypt are even more confused. Lately, things have been so volatile and unpredictable that forecasting news, events, and social progression has been a guessing game and a mere stab in the dark. Due to its rich history, strategic geographic location, and resources, it is unquestionable that governments around the world have a vested interest in Egypt and its instability. The Gulf and petrodollar countries have a vested interest in keeping the Muslim Brotherhood in power out of fear that the masses will win and democratic desire will sweep across the region. the U.S. and other Western countries will invest in any of those who help upkeep the instability that has diseased the country for the past 30 years. Having said this, please note that what I will talk about next is not far-fetched, but it is a repeated pattern we have seen in the past and that I cannot look past anymore. And this is what I got from the people I met. Why does the U.S. want extremist Muslim in power? Because when Hillary came, she met the Muslim Brotherhood, not only the president, but the Murshid, who is not supposed to be in the government. How can we understand that the same U.S. that fought Al-Qaeda is the same U.S. that is helping Islamist group in power? How can we understand Europe that chose to separate from the church is blessing government governed through the mosque? How could we explain the West that adopted democratic governments and considered the best civilized countries are now helping extreme religious governments in our part of the world under the banner of democracy? What is the desired end picture of, after all? Is it to create a democratically run countries or religious governments? To think that the West is against Islamic extremists is ridiculous, because Islam is for the West as valuable as oil. They benefited a lot from Islam. For decades, the West was gaining directly and indirectly from Islamic groups. They cemented the jihad ideology to help with the fight of communist atheism in the ex-Soviet Union, where extremists proved to be obedient tools, easy to manipulate when needed. We have seen extremist sheikhs declare fatwa after fatwa to set groups with different sects against each other. And with the help of Christians and the Western power, they spread disorder, violence, bloodshed, and treason. So why would the West entertain the idea of eradicating extremist Muslim if they can make use of this trump card? They can draft extremist sheikhs, mujahideen, and spies to control the simple-minded and poor Muslims. Muslim extremists were and still are a useful tool in the hands of the West to topple patriotic governments that stand against the interests of colonial imperialists. It is well known that Muslim extremists are good at atonement and turning people off from other different sects. They are also known for their power to promote capitalism and make it shine. They chose the right words from the Quran to reach the simple-minded Muslims so they can control their emotions, brainwash them, and even recruit them to join them in the same trench they belong to, namely NATO and the Pentagon. Colonizing happened in both Sunni and Shia. The ascendancy of Shia extremists in Iran ensured a balance of religion in the region so that Israel will now be same religious country in the area. And also it helped create a perfect enemy that would give reasons for the aggressive intervention in the affairs of the neighboring countries using all means. The U.S. used the Iranian government to milk the Gulf states by posing as their savior and protector from the dangers of the Shia Iranians. And that, of course, opened the door to aggressive military interventions to have full control over the Gulf. That's why the U.S. supported the extremist Islamist movement born from the Wahhabi ideology to stand against the communist danger and the ex-atheist. To face the Shia's warped ideology, converted the faceless takfir was used as an effective weapon to fight any opposing belief. The West succeeded in using this weapon to its fullest. It isolated Iran from its neighbors and made it enemy with its surrounding countries, especially the countries of Sunni Islam. Using the Mujahideen, the West succeeded in removing the Soviet Union from Afghanistan. In the process, they sacrificed millions of innocent people. They used the same religious tactics in Iran. Bombing both Muslim and Christians' holy sites was to create a feeling of threat and hatred between them. That, of course, fueled the voice of extremists. Let's not forget to mention the role played by the media. Some promoted, stressed on, and deepened the rift in the mind and souls of Muslims, besides accusing each other of blasphemies. The success of the West in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Sudan further encouraged them to invest in the political Islam. and make use of Islamic groups to pull the curtain on the final act of the indirect colonial plan. Islamists were used as fuels and volunteer soldiers against the Soviet Union, while thousands of Muslims studied for free. Let's not forget to mention that the Soviet Union never mobilized its armaments against Egypt. This is how Islamists lost the focus on their enemy and directed their attention on the enemy of the Arab enemy. Ultimately, they created a social and religious rift within the country so as to weaken the state as a whole, making it easier to govern, manipulate, and colonize. Internal instability creates vulnerability, which led to more direct control by Western states. So what did Islam gain from extremist Muslims? There is a correlation between understanding the meaning of religion and the breaking down of a country. This happened when religion is used to provoke a group that feels marginalized and prosecuted. This kind of relationship was apparent in the breakdown of Yugoslavia, the Islamist experience in Sudan, and Hamas in Palestine, where Hamas infiltrated the political arena through a democratic election, then turned against the democracy standards. It resulted in the deaths of many Palestinians and created a tear in the national homogeneity of the Palestinian people, which was the reason in the creation of two states, the West Bank and Gaza. The same happened in Sudan when Islamists took over. They divided the largest Arabic country into Christian-dominated North Sudan and Muslim-dominated South Sudan. This was as a result of enforcing the Sharia on all Sudanese people, Muslims and non-Muslim. A civil war broke, followed by foreign interference and infiltration of world organization after both parties were strained from fighting, and this is when the division dish was cooked to perfection. Then came the magical solution, a referendum. We all know the rest of the story. South Sudan was handed to the West and their allies. This was a painful punch to Islam and scary example if it gets repeated in the Arab world. There are now worries that the Sudan example might be adopted in Egypt. I was told that I only have 3 minutes. Is it over?
Go ahead and finish your thought.
Can I finish?
Please.
The repeated burnings of Coptic churches was aimed at provoking Christians to help them push for separation. Then the West would mobilize and come to rescue the oppressed Christians from Islamist monsters. In Iraq, it was a different story. Islamists came on the tankers of the West. In Libya, they came on NATO aircrafts. We are not that naive to believe that the Arab Spring happened instantaneously or by a stroke of luck, or even by the will of the people that brought the Islamists to power in Tunis, Egypt, Libya, and Morocco. It was well thought of revolution and devilishly executed. What happened seems like an Indian movie, or better yet, a good American movie. The West plans really succeeded in bringing the Islamists to power, as was planned for years. Unfortunately, those Islamists, in their elation with the new seat, ignored the fact that they were purposely brought in power to light up the torch of religion in the area and to spread terrorism for the West to fight. The creation of Islamic countries would put fear in the heart of non-Muslim people. They would feel threatened and rejected, creating the perfect reason for migration, and then the breaking down of the country becomes ripe. For sure, Islamists will not accept a democratic government, and the division of Egypt becomes a must. In dealing with Islamists, the West uses the tactics of support and attack at the same time. The extremists will help in the creation of the new Middle East with their extremists. It's a brilliant plan. It served many purposes to the West with the least expenses and in the shortest time. I will stop here.
Thank you very much, Lila. And a reminder for those of you who haven't sent in questions, I encourage you to do so. I see you're definitely have some good questions coming for discussion. But first, let's hear from Boubacar Kanté, and who recently went to Mali for some of his insight.
Assalamu So, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here. So my approach will be a little bit different. It's not going to be a usual speech. And I will first ask how many of you actually can locate Mali on a map now? Wow, that's quite impressive, I would say. I'm very surprised. I'm sure that the fact that Mali has been pretty much in the news recently is actually one of the main reasons you can do so. Probably 3 or 4 months ago, the number of people able to locate Mali would be much lower. So I am a scientist, so my approach to things are a little bit different again. So what I want to say is that as a physicist or a scientist, I like to look at the world as being a complex system in which you have an ensemble of variables as the climate, religion, and all of these variables are changing the output and the different events that we observe. And what you want to do, you want to be able to predict those events, to know what's going to happen tomorrow, or at least to try to understand what is happening today. This is very difficult. So I will try to say a little bit more about Mali to convey a message so that you can, after maybe my talk, understand better by yourself what is happening and be able to do a better judgment, because all judgments are subjective. So I can give you my opinion, but I'm not sure that opinion is right. So I prefer to give you the element that will allow you to decide and judge by yourself. So Mali is a landlocked country, so one of the poorest countries in the world, where I would say from 1990, a rapid economic growth coupled to a flourishing democracy came thanks to the installation of democracy in Africa around 1990. So at that time, since 1990 then, you could be president of Mali for 2 terms maximum, 2 times 5 years, and that has been working pretty much until very recently, until last year. So I will maybe tell you a little bit more about, well, Mali is not in the Middle East first, so it can be surprising to see me here talking about Mali, but unfortunately or fortunately, things are very related to each other, and the events that you are seeing now are directly related to the Arab Spring. So just to say maybe a little bit on the history of Mali, just a couple of things to situate this country. Mali has been very famous, actually, in the past. Many empires have succeeded each other in this part of the world, the Ghana Empire, the Mali Empire, and the Songhai Empire. Those were in the medieval era. And then today it's a country of about 14 million inhabitants, with 7 countries as neighbors, so Mauritania, Senegal, Guinea, Ivory Coast, Burkina Faso, Niger, and Algeria. So this is a lot of countries around. And Mali is also the country, I would say, at the junction of the Arab world and sub-Saharan Africa. So it's a mixed country, so we have people from everywhere. We have Arabs, we have Tuaregs, we have Bambara, Songhai, different languages, different cultures, but people who have been able to live together for thousands of years, for many, many years, for a long time. It has not been a big issue so far. Of course, there are always, wherever you go in the world, I've been living in many different countries. I was born in Mali, grew up in Gabon, in Central Africa, did my undergrad and my graduate studies in France, and today I'm talking to you here. So I've seen that people are different, but that should not prevent us to live together. So if we talk to each other, we exchange, we can come to a common ground. So Mali has been in the news again recently, not for good reason. And the changes in this country are due to many things. If I talk a little bit about the climate, the north of the country is a big desert, so it's pretty hard to live there. The south is a little bit easier to live in the south, and most of the population is actually in the south of the country. And for a long time, thousands of years ago or even more recently, Mali was doing a lot of exchanges with the Middle East, with Europe, thanks to gold. We have a lot of gold in the country. And Timbuktu, which is a well-known city. In the U.S., people talk about Timbuktu. Most of the people actually didn't know that that city was existing, but it is a city in Mali, a very famous city. I used to compare Timbuktu to the city I'm living in now, in Berkeley. So Timbuktu had a big university in the past. And Timbuktu had about actually 30,000 students studying there on a regular basis, religion, philosophy, sciences. And this is about the size of Berkeley today. But if you go to Timbuktu today, there is nothing. It's a very poor city with, unfortunately, with what we have seen recently, with very old ideas and actually not ideas for progress, I would say. So I have said a little bit on the history. So let me now come back to the current event. So when Gaddafi was overthrown in Libya two years ago, so basically what happened is that the Tuaregs, who are at the junction of many countries in this area, Mali, Algeria, Libya, Mauritania, Niger, so those are people with a common language. And since 1960, they were not very happy when borders were created because they are nomadic people. And of course, they are not happy with borders because going through the desert has become more difficult for them. So since 1960, that has been a problem when most of the African countries obtained their independence. And Mali and other countries in the region have been having regularly problems with Tuaregs because they wanted to have some kind of Tuareg state in that region, and that did not happen 50 years ago. So when Gaddafi was overthrown, a lot of Tuaregs, we all know how Libya was managed by Gaddafi, they were controlling the south of the country. So when Gaddafi was overthrown, they decided to go further south. When Gaddafi was overthrown again by NATO, so they came and settled for different reasons that I'm not going to discuss today. But they came and settled in the north of Mali. And when they came there, they decided to ally with a group that is now known as Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, Al-Qaeda or Maghreb Islamic, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And they ally with those to expel the Malian government from the north of the country. So they were more powerful because they had sophisticated weapons from Libya. And Mali is a very, very poor country. And we decided the last 20 years not to invest in weapons, which is quite reasonable because if people cannot eat, I don't know why we would buy weapons. So so that was a wise decision, but unfortunately you have also to face the world you are living in. By taking such a decision, we also expose ourselves to these rebellions and these people coming from elsewhere. So they took over the country, at least two-thirds of the country, the north of Mali, and then decided to kidnap tourists, decided to ask for ransom, decided to install Sharia law, in particular shopping people and people fit for different reasons. And this was completely opposite to the vision of people in my country, at least the vision that I have been living in, which was a very welcoming country and where people have been sharing things and for a very long time. So they decided to then settle in the north. The military was so unhappy at that time that they decided to do a military coup in the country, in Bamako, further south, because they considered that the government was not dealing properly with the rebellion. And all the instability started like that. So the rebels come, a military coup was done, and since then the country has been very, very weak. In reality, unable to deal with this issue by itself. So early this year, in January, Mali asked for help. In fact, what happened previously is that the military who did the coup was requested to step down from ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, and also the international community requested the same thing. It's very strange because in some countries there is a military coup. I don't know. This is not a judgment. I don't know. In some countries there is a military coup. Nothing is said. It is accepted. In other countries, when there is a military coup, military are asked to step down. So I don't know what is the logic here. But in Mali, they were requested to step down, which was, in my sense, okay, which was good. So we came back to a constitutional order. And after that order, so the new legitimate government, which is an interim government, is leading the country and is supposed to organize election in July with the pressure of the international community, especially of France, because we cannot be in this interim regime for too long. So French came, helped Mali take over the north, and then this actually started when I was there in January 11th exactly, And most of the people actually are very happy that France came to help. And so France is starting to withdraw because, I mean, they cannot be there for too long. It's expensive for them. And they also intervene not only to help Mali because it is also a threat not only for Mali but for the whole world. Because if they have a safe haven where they can train, they can take advantage of that and prepare to attack other places as well. So those are the few elements that I wanted to share with you. I mean, there are many, many groups. The group that I was talking about, which is known as Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, is actually nothing else than a former Algerian group, which is called GSPC. So Groupe Salafiste pour la Prédication et le Combat. So Salafist group for preaching and combat. They were fighting with the Algerian government for a long time. Of course, the Algerian government is stronger. They decided to settle in the south of Algeria. And to gain international recognition, they changed their name to Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And then those people, of course, expanded a little bit their activities. South of Algeria is nothing else but the north of Mali, a big desert where government have very little control, and then and so on and so forth. So this is what I wanted to say, and I will just maybe let you ask your question later, but just a few, last sentences. Democracy came to Africa and to the world as a way to be in a more peaceful environment where we can all benefit from resources that are available. But unfortunately in Africa, what I have seen at least, what I'm still seeing, is that unfortunately democracy is confiscated somehow by some leaders. So the people are not seeing the return of democracy on their own life. And this is why, and it is extremely dangerous. It's not the case everywhere, but it is extremely dangerous in my sense. If democracy or extremism and poverty are combined, it's going to be extremely dangerous for the world. Because those people in Mali or elsewhere, extremely poor, of course, the country is not doing anything for them, and they are just more open to other ideas that are extremely dangerous. So I think the fight against terrorism is an interesting fight, but we also need to look at the fundamentals. Fight against poverty so that people are freer and can express themselves in a better and safer environment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Boubacar. And now a reminder to our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's discussion is on the Arab Spring 2013, and we are very fortunate to have with us panelists Joel Brinkley, Laila El-Sisi, and Boubacar Conte. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and I'm about to present some of your excellent questions to our panel for discussion. Let's start with this one. I think, Joel, it might be pertinent to start with you, considering you addressed this during your talk, and that's, if we don't have the same meaning for democracy, what is the definition of democracy in the Arab world?
I don't think you can typecast the Arab world all in one sentence, but in places where there have been elections, generally, there's one election and that's it. Right? This is not the Arab world, but Pakistan, for the first time, the government is stepping down, so that's encouraging. But the definition of democracy in the Arab world, well, I think every country's different. They look at the United States as a democracy, but they also, many of them also look at it as the United States is an aggressive, arrogant country that they don't like. So I don't think we, the United States, are the model for most people in the Arab world at all.
Your thoughts, Laila?
Please,
jump right in.
Okay, I really don't think there is any democracy in the Arab world because the West doesn't want a democratic government. They want actually puppets. But right now with the Islamists in government in the most of the Arab world, democracy does not exist in Islam because those people, they follow a leader, as they say. They have a leader, is the Murshid, and they don't have democracy. It doesn't exist in Islam. So this is all what I can tell you. All those countries that they will follow the Muslim Brotherhood governments, they do not believe in Islam because in democracy because it doesn't really exist in Islam.
So I will maybe also add a small comment to that. First of all, I don't agree with that the fact that democracy do not exist in Islam, because what is Islam? That's the question first. Because the way Islam is practiced in Mali, which is a country where 90% of the people are Muslim, is extremely different from what the way it is practiced in Saudi Arabia. So Mali has been a Muslim country for a long time, of course different from Egypt, but democracy has been existing for some time. And I would say the question of what is democracy is a question that can be asked to the Arab world. It can be also be asked here in the U.S. I mean, it is a perpetual thinking. We have to think about that democracy all the time. It is something that is not there forever. We have to fight for it to keep it. Democracy is not a notion that is can be taken over time. Every country in the world has to deal with what the way it sees democracy. And this is what I can say.
Great, thank you. Here's a question a little more narrowly tailored for Lila, and that being, Americans may be wrong in suggesting that Arab Spring is about democracy, but surely Egyptian women want greater rights and do not want to lose at least those limited rights they acquired under Mubarak. True?
Oh, yeah, true, yes. If it wasn't for women, believe me, this revolution would not have even started. Women are so strong in demanding the changes in the governments in Egypt. But as I said, you cannot separate religion from politics. And religion does not give freedom to women. So it's like a dilemma. How can you do that? I don't believe that there will be any government that comes in the Arab countries, Muslim countries, that will separate politics from religion when it comes to women only. Only when it comes to women, because it's written in the Quran, rules for women, and everyone is interpreting it the way they want. But in reality, it's oppressive to women. So that's all what I can say.
Great. Here's a question asking, what are the chances of Morsi's government being toppled, and is the Obama government going to continue to back him as an ally?
Do you want me to
do
that?
Why don't you?
I love the winces. That shows you're coming up with good questions.
Okay, the Obama administration, really, they got a big surprise when the revolution happened. They didn't really count on the masses that went in the street. And right now, the Obama is saying, oh, those people are now out and they don't want Morsi, I better join the street. And they will not support Morsi, trust me. Once it comes that he will be toppled, and this will be very soon, he is going to be out. And mark my word, I remember I was on a panel and I talked about the Muslim Brotherhood before they came in office, and I told you, everybody, that they will be taking Egypt in a dark tunnel, and here I am. I told you so, and I'm saying it again. They will leave.
Joel, did you want to weigh in?
Yes. You know, the United States and Egypt, I covered the State Department for a good number of years, and there's a dilemma that the State Department and the U.S. government faces every time you have a leader like Morsi. If you supply aid and have good relations, then you have the chance to influence things. That's the thinking. The other side of it is, if you cut off aid and cut off relations, then you have no ability to influence things. And this is an unending debate in Washington, but Egypt is a country that's too big and too important simply to cut off because we don't like the leader. That's where this administration and probably any administration would come down in the end.
Well, here's part two of that question, and one of our audience members asked, suppose Morsi is ousted, is there a well-qualified person to replace him, at least one that the United States could work with?
Believe me, any buddy in the street can replace that guy. Anyone, any little kid can talk better than him. So this is an excuse that they have been saying all the time. But Egypt has a lot of educated, way much more educated than Morsi and all the Muslim Brotherhood. And when they leave, we can, you know, have a lot better than that. Believe me, this is a question. It gets me irritated when people ask it, as if Egypt has nobody better than Morsi. It's not true. Egypt has a lot of young people who can run. We have a lot of women who can run the country, too.
Question for Boubacar about, in Mali, the influence of outsiders, specifically Canadian troops and France's role. How is that being perceived in the country?
That's an interesting question. In the country, at the beginning, I would say when the military coup was done last year, what the military wanted to happen is foreign troops or France, US or Canadian help them get more weapons so that they can take a kind of revenge, take the north by themselves. But of course, that also would maybe lead to some abuse of use of power from the military. So that did not happen. And it was very difficult to convince Mali militaries that foreign troops had to come to do it by themselves. So in the end, given the state of Mali army today, I mean, most of the people in Mali didn't know what was really happening. It was just an army of people getting a salary every month, but they didn't have any weapon. They couldn't do anything. So this is now clear to us. So after this understanding, I think most of the people in Mali now, actually, from my experience, from what I have seen, again, I want to insist on this, it is subjective. From what I have seen, people are very happy to have a French troop right now there helping Mali to take over the north. But there is another program, because you cannot help someone forever. The person needs to be able to take over by himself or by herself. So now European Union has a program to educate Mali army and help Mali recruit the army. Basically having new equipment for the army and educate those people to human rights and a lot of things. So that program is going on right now, and progressively Mali army is supposed to take over and replace French troops. So this is the way it is seen there now.
With all the attention we've had over the last couple of years on the Arab Spring, an audience member asked, is the Israeli-Palestinian situation as critical as ever to stability in the Middle East? And if so, what do you think the Obama administration can do in the next few years?
Nothing.
The questions are not easy.
When I left, the first time I worked in Israel was 20 years ago, and I was there for 4 years. So when I left and went around speaking, and people asked me, when is the Israeli-Palestinian issue going to be settled? And I said, not in my lifetime. That was 20 years ago, and I say it again today. That's how I feel. You have a right-wing government in Israel, some of whose members believe that the West Bank belongs to Israel. John Kerry was there just a few days ago trying to work out some kind of arrangement where both sides put out an offer to encourage the other to come along, and Netanyahu refused. I don't see this settled, and I don't think anybody in the Arab world sees a settlement of this anytime soon either.
Yeah, you're right.
No notes of optimism from our other panelists.
This question is extremely interesting and extremely complex as well. I also don't see a settlement in my lifetime or so. But what I can say is that apparently I don't know why the world always needs a hotspot at any time. So this is just an observation. We have had in the past, of course, human life is very short, so we think that everything happened within 100 years, but humans have been here for a very long time. So for our time, the Israeli-Palestinian problem seem to be the hotspot. And I think we really need to address this problem because, unfortunately, for some reason, it is being the source of a lot of other problems in the Middle East and even in Africa today. So if I look at Africa, because this is where I'm from, I take a country like Nigeria with some extremist group, with people bombing themselves, suicide bombing in Africa. It happened in Mali for the first time in February. This is extremely dangerous. We have never seen this before. Of course, Africa, and we have been poor for a long time, but people never killed themselves because they were suffering. For the first time in the history of my country, somebody bombed itself in the north. So, and I used, when bombing was happening, when I was in Gabon, I was sitting in my living room. I usually don't like to think in terms of example. I was sitting in the living room with my dad, and we were looking at television, seeing a bombing in the Middle East. My dad told me, if somebody is ready to lose a life to kill others, there is no solution. So we really need to address Palestinian-Israeli problem in order to stop this kind of hemorrhagic. This is what I could say.
Ayla?
Lifetime? Yeah, no. If Israel wants to end this dilemma between the Palestinian and the Israelis in Israel, they should really support Morsi, because Morsi is willing to give the Sinai to put all the Palestinian there and then get them out of Gaza. So they should do that. This guy is calling Netanyahu his friend, and before, during Mubarak, he was. They killed Sadat for making peace with Israel.
To Boubacar Kanti's point that there always is a hot spot in the world, we turn to Syria. Our audience asks, what should the world do about the Syrian tragedy?
In Syria, we can I say?
That's why you're here.
In Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood are really working on hands and foot to take Assad out. They are there, and Morsi. You have to understand that Khayrat al-Shatir, the one of the Muslim Brotherhood member in Egypt, he is the leader of all the Muslim Brotherhood in the world. They are in 70 countries. So they are they are a big organization, and they are sending troops, militia, Muslim Brotherhood militia, to help the Syrian people. And they are the one who are really causing the whole mess in Syria. Maybe you don't agree with me, but they are causing all this mess in Syria. I don't like Bashar, and I don't like the way he is, but we didn't see any killings before that. Suddenly, it's just like they are killing each other like ants. And now we know, in Egypt, we know all the young people in the streets are talking about that, are talking about the Muslim Brotherhood being in Syria, and they are doing the killing.
Well, there are actually several Islamic groups in Syria, and I think what's going to happen, I'm sorry to say, is that when Bashar al-Assad falls, and he will fall, there's going to be a civil war. You probably saw that just this week, the Syrian al-Qaeda group, al-Nusra, allied with al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is larger and much better equipped. And there is little doubt that when the government falls, the al-Qaeda forces in Syria will start another war with what you might call the legitimate Syrian rebels, the former army officers and so forth. And it's not going to be a pretty picture.
Question for all of our speakers. In your opinion, looking at this conflict in the Middle East, how much of it is ultimately based on a Shia-Sunni struggle for power and control?
Well, Syria is partly that, of course. The majority of Syria is Sunni, and the government is Shiite. I've spent a lot of time working in Iraq, and that divide is alive and well. But look at Egypt. That it doesn't play in Egypt at all. I don't think it – I'm not the expert. Our expert's over here, but I don't think that's part of the Mali conflict at all.
But They try, right.
It depends on which part of the Arab world you're talking about.
I think there are many aspects on this point is also present in Mali, actually. It's not obvious. And I would say all conflicts in the world are always based on control or some kind of power. So in Mali in particular, of course, that point is not obvious yet. If you were following a little bit more maybe French news, you will see that it's very surprising to people. People are asking themselves, why is France in Mali, this very poor country with no resources? And they spend so much money to help Malians. So they are suddenly very nice to a friend, to Mali. I mean, it's very surprising. And of course, the zero order answer would be it is for peace and to fight terrorism. But if you think a little bit further, you will see that there is the biggest exporter of uranium in the world is Niger. Niger is a neighboring country of Mali, and that uranium, France is a big nuclear power, so that uranium is coming from Niger. So uranium is a very important source for energy in France. So they have to have control over that area to protect the source of energy. And there is also thinking and ideas saying that there is some uranium or some oil in the north of Mali, which is a big desert. There is oil in Algeria in the north, so there is no reason that we have no oil in Mali. There is oil on the east in Niger, uranium. There is no reason that we don't have uranium. People have been investigating, including US, Canada, UK, many countries, even Algeria have been investigating the north of Mali for this kind of reason. So there is always an interest somewhere. And then coming back to the link between Sufism and Wahhabism and this kind of thing, this also exists of Mali because there is overall kind of influence changing the way people are practicing. You can see these patterns in Mali that was not there before, but I have seen going there every year that there is more and more mosques built from this by this country. I don't want to cite anyone. But this is just a way to enforce and increase your influence somewhere and get more power.
Well, Shia and Sunni and Coptic and Christian and all this has been introduced to the Middle East. We never had any problem with them, with the Shia or the Coptic. This is something important to us for divide and conquer. This is a way to divide the Arab world. And it's not going to work in Egypt. It has been tried, and they are now trying again, burning churches and all this. But the people in Egypt, they go in the street and they hold together the cross and the Quran, and they say, "We will never allow this to happen here." So you know, this is. I remember King Farouk, his sister married the from the Shia from the. You know, the king's sister, I think, son or something. So we never had problems with Shia and Sunni. It's important.
Unfortunately, we have reached the moment where we're down to one last question. So I bring this from an audience member who perhaps is looking for a sign of hope out of this discussion and asking, what can we as citizens do to help work for peace? I quote our questioner, "I feel helpless in this confusion."
Yeah.
What can we do as citizens to help peace? Communicate, tell the truth to people you are directly in contact with, your family, your friends, people in your city, inform people, because I think the more you know, the less likely you are to do extreme acts. So you have to know. It's better to know than not know. That I would say. Communicate with people, tell the truth, exactly what you are doing today. Because if you are here, it means that you are concerned about something that is happening far from your country. See, if most of the people in the U.S. were like you, we'd live in a very peaceful world.
Don't support the Congress when they want money to go to war and spend the money on in the Middle East, you know, for stupid reasons like the one in Iraq.
Joel?
I think the largest thing we can do, I write, and if you know how to write, that's a good way to get involved. But the other thing is to keep informed and vote for the people who you think will do the right thing for us in the United States as it relates to the Middle East.
Thank you very much. And please join me in thanking Joel Brinkley, Wyla El-Sisi, and Boubacar Kanté for their comments here today about the Arab Spring. I also want to thank our audience that was listening on radio and the Internet. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. In this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.